Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. One of the things I would do, if I could do it all over again, is study and work for insects and their habitat. Maybe it's not too late to accomplish some of this dream. The importance of insects to our world's health cannot be overstated. I found an essay that captured my imagination, and I'm so happy to be able to share it with you. It's about forest bees. We'll climb into the canopy and do some observing with Cass Urban-Mead, who completed her PhD research at Cornell before joining the Xerces Society as a pollinator conservation specialist and NRCS partner biologist. She grew up raising dairy goats in the Hudson Valley. I found this essay in a quarterly publication of the Xerces Society called Wings. Xerces is an international organization dedicated to protecting the natural world by conserving invertebrates and their habitat. In the 2021 annual report, they write, "We work day in and day out to make our landscapes safer for these vital animals. To reverse the decline in insects, we need to protect nature that remains, restore nature that is degraded, and replicate nature as best we can in as many places as possible. In short, we need to repair and maintain the fabric of life," unquote. Let's climb into a huge maple with Cass. This essay is called The Secret Life of Forest Bees. It's a cool April day in the woods around Trumansburg, a small town on the shores of Lake Cayuga in the Finger Lakes region of New York State. Despite our heavy packs, my friend Greg and I step gingerly to avoid crushing bloodroot, early meadow rue, and trout lily. An hour later, at the base of a large sugar maple tree, we've unpacked and begun our safety rundown using an alphabet-based mnemonic. Anchor? Check. Safely in place. Belts and buckles? Check. All tight. Carabiner? Check. And three extra for good measure. Devices? Check. My extra long-handled butterfly net and several jars tied onto the climbing belt. End of rope? Check. Securely tied and tangle-free. And finally, friends? Of course, one never climbs alone. A slight breeze rustles the branches overhead, and I take the first big step of my long vertical climb. Slowly and steadily, I ascend to the strong crotch near the top of the tree, where the rope, which was flung up there using a giant slingshot before I began climbing, loops back to the ground. This is as high as I can go. I'm at about 65 feet, with a side view of the branches of oak, tulip tree, and the occasional sugar maple reaching to the sky. Some have begun to push out their sweet, pea-green, early spring leaves, while others are still bare twigs, displaying only buds or early flowers. Mid-story, red maple, hop-hornbeam, and black cherry grab the sunshine between them in the airspace below. My body gets accustomed to the regular swaying of the branches, and I wave to Greg, who is now tiny, distant, on the dappled forest floor. I grab my net as a gust of wind dies down and focus on the dangling sugar maple catkins, waiting for the magic to begin. A bumblebee queen buzzes in, and three bee-mimicking flower flies land on a mature catkin bursting with pollen. I notice a metallic green sweat bee, and then several mining bees, both male and female. A cellophane bee, more commonly found on the earlier blooming red maple, even deigns to drop by. The average sugar maple tree makes 100 billion pollen grains. The oaks that bloom a few weeks later make even more. And to my absolute delight, it seems that the bees have figured it out. These climbs and observations were part of my dissertation work at Cornell University, where I collaborated with an amazing team of scientists to try to answer a simple question. Why do apple orchards with forests nearby have more bees in them? Indeed, there is consistent evidence that agricultural fields that are near forests, hedgerows, and woodlots have both more bees and more kinds of bees. Moreover, Mia Park, then also at Cornell, showed that having more nearby natural habitat somewhat mitigated the negative effects of high pesticide loads on bees visiting apple orchard. Before Europeans arrived, the area that is now the northeastern United States was mostly covered in forest. So some sort of relationship between bees and woods makes sense. Forests have always included regular disturbances. Gaps and patches of varying sizes were created by beaver dams, wind storms, and fire, often through intentional indigenous management, which created a varied matrix of heterogeneous habitat. This was true before colonial land clearing, and it's true now that our second growth forests have regrown, bearing with them the legacies of pastures and crop fields. So although we correctly think of bees as creatures that vibrantly fill our gardens, meadows, and fields, the 600 species that occur in the region evolved in a forested landscape. Some bees are harder to see, but there are many that you can discover with no climbing required. At ankle height are the bees who visit spring ephemerals, flowers that bloom in sunshine during the period between winter and when the canopy trees fully leaf out, plunging the forest floor into the deep shadow of summer. One well-known forest floor forager is the spring beauty mining bee, Andrena erigeniae. As with other solitary species, each female builds her own nest, a series of small chambers off of an underground tunnel, each chamber supplied with a pile of pollen large enough to feed a single baby bee. She is a specialist collecting pollen only from the flowers of two species of spring beauty, Claytonia. Her leg hairs are adapted to be just the right size and shape for gathering spring beauty pollen and are so efficient that she barely drops any of it as she forages. There are other mining bee species that specialize on plants such as bellwort, geranium, and trout lily. This specialization is possible because the bees are active as adults for only the brief window during which their host flowers bloom. In other ways, wait out the year, turning slowly from eggs to larvae to pupae, deep underground in their nests. Shift your gaze from the flowers toward the leaf litter, and you're perfectly poised to find bees scouting for nest sites. Bumblebee queens, having mated in the fall and hibernated all winter, diligently pursue their need to establish nests. I usually see bumblebees searching for nest sites in the woods on well-drained sloping hillsides that are covered with leaf litter. Because bumblebees are active all season, they cannot afford to specialize on just a single type of flower. They'd be hungry when it stops blooming, so you'll instead see them visit a wide range of flowers for the energy to support their colonies. They are hairier and messier than the specialists, and as a result are particularly good pollinators, dropping pollen onto flowers as they look for food. Another bee you're likely to see weaving across the forest floor in early spring is a master of disguise. Bees in the genus Nomada are cuckoo bees, meaning they don't build nests of their own. Instead, a cuckoo bee camouflages itself with a special chemical perfume, sneaks inside another bee's nest, and lays an egg on the pollen the host bee has gathered. Cuckoos have a wasp-like look, with red or yellow markings and thickened exoskeletons to protect them in case they get caught. When the cuckoo larva hatches, it kills the mining bee larva and eats all the pollen. It's easy to imagine someone casting cuckoos as villains, but researchers believe that seeing them year after year is actually a good sign, since abundant cuckoo bees suggest an abundant population of host bees. The next strategy for forest bee spotting, if it's green and glinting, check it out. Many forest insects are gorgeously iridescent, probably because their sheen confuses predators when they fly between dappled sun and shade. Two of my favorite forest bees shimmer in the dappled light. The metallic green, Algochlora pura, and the shiny blue, Lasioglossum coruleum, they're active all summer, have generalist diets, and will usually build their burrows in abandoned beetle holes of an eighth to 5/16 of an inch in diameter in dead wood. Stumps, standing snags, and debris are crucial habitat for these bee species. Other stem and cavity nesting bees, such as mason bees, also using pre-existing beetle holes or hollow, pithy stems of plants. You may be surprised that sugar maple and oak trees host bees. Indeed, trees in the northeastern forest have not usually been considered bee forage because many, such as poplar, ash, birch, alder, hickory, and oak, are wind-pollinated. This makes sense. It is windy, cold, and often rainy in spring, so most spring-blooming trees take advantage of that air movement and spread their pollen in the breeze, rather than relying on small insects that don't like the cold to make the journey up to their flowers. But since the trees make billions of protein-filled grains, many bees gather and bring the pollen home to rear their young anyway. Although not widely studied, one recent review paper pulled together every incidental mention in old literature records of pollen collection from wind-pollinated plants. They found 200 pollen collection records from more than 100 genera of wind-pollinated plants. For example, old natural history papers note that mason and mining bees love oak, while metallic green sweat bees visit walnut trees. In New York apple orchards, Laura Russo, while a postdoc at Cornell, had identified lots of pollen carried by bees and found that they also carried some maple, willow, ash, and birch pollen. Inspired by this prior research, I started my dissertation fieldwork in March of 2017 and continued it during the next two springs. Using special bee traps in 11 forests and woodlots adjacent to orchards, I found more than 90 species of wild bees active in the forest canopy between March and the end of May. After then spending long pandemic months staring at bees under a microscope, I found that tree pollens often make up between 25 and 100% of the pollen in an individual bee's digestive tract. Oak and maple were the primary trees visited for pollen, but I also occasionally found beech, walnut, ash, and birch. In my study area, the canopy trees were a big part of bees' diets before apple orchards bloomed. Once the fruit trees bloomed, the bees were more abundant in the orchards, and their diets transitioned to include both canopy pollens and lots of apple pollen. It was obvious that many bees moved from the forest to the orchards during apple bloom. Although research on forest bees is increasing, we have really just scratched the surface when it comes to understanding them. These bees forage for pollen in forests, but also use canopy trees as places in which to collect honeydew and resins, glean resources for self-medication, hide out in microclimates buffered against temperature extremes, and gather on tall trees sought out as mating sites. We have much more to learn about each of these. One thing we do know is that for these bees to persist, they need the right forest conditions. Most forest ownership in the Northeast is private, so actions taken on back woodlots and private properties can have huge implications for conservation. These bees might rely on the presence of the tree canopy, but it's vital that we not stop managing woodlands or cease cutting trees. The openings in these forests are also very important for supplying the resources that help provide for the entire life cycle of bees. Ecological forestry also helps maintain tree diversity, creates a variety of niches for wildlife, and keeps forests resistant to pathogens and resilient in the face of climate change. According to research from Rutgers University, about a third of bee species in the Northeast seem to rely heavily on forest habitats, while other species need both forests and fields and move frequently between them. Still other bees can thrive in more developed landscapes. So in order to support all of the species, we need a landscape with forests, openings, meadows, and every habitat in between. Luckily, there are many programs that foster healthy forest management for wildlife. For a land manager working with a certified forester to address climate resilience, tree diversity, structural diversity, and wildlife elements for other animals usually creates synergy with forest bee conservation. Snags for raptor nests, for example, are also homes for wood nesting bees. Piles of logs for salamanders can also protect bumblebee nests. Clear-cutting a monoclonal beech stand that is dying of beech bark disease can generate a healthy tree community that provides forage for bees. Similarly, in the case of ecologically sensitive prescribed burns, most soil nesting bees can either rapidly recolonize afterward or are nesting deeply enough to not be impacted, and then will be thrilled to see the flush of flowers after the burn. Excessive deer browsing is one of the major threats to forest health, and thus forest bee health. So perhaps most important of all are fences and other deer management protocols to protect regenerating tree seedlings and our delicate and beautiful spring ephemerals and the bees that rely on them. Although bees are commonly thought of as animals of open places, indeed one of the best known lines of poetry about bees is Emily Dickinson's, "To make a prairie, it takes a clover and one bee," which reinforces this perception. The forests that abut our communities and farmlands play an essential role in sustaining diverse bee populations. Few people have, or perhaps even desire, the opportunity that I've had for close-up exploration of the forest canopy, but all of us can find opportunities to appreciate bees at ground level. And that's the end of Cass Urban Mead's essay, In Wings, published by the Xerces Society. We have a Xerces biologist right here, based in Wisconsin, Micah Kloppenberg, who I first learned about when he worked as an ecologist for the Blue Mounds Project. As the ecologist there, Micah supported landowners in achieving their habitat protection and restoration goals, and he worked for a county parks department where he developed and led creative conservation activities and programming for youth and community groups. Check out the Blue Mounds Project at bluemounds.org. Micah is now the Wisconsin Pollinator Conservation Specialist for Xerces. Micah provides technical assistance to agricultural producers, land stewards, and community groups interested in creating and protecting pollinator habitat. Micah holds a master's degree in restoration ecology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he studied plant community change in remnant hillside prairies in the Driftless region. He enjoys canoeing, dabbling in jewelry, metal art, and growing as many onions and garlic as he and his family can fit into their small garden. So I hope this has provided a new insight for you into the bees that you see around you, and realize that there's so much we don't know, and it's so fun to know that people are exploring the tops of the trees. I want to thank the people at the Xerces Society for giving me permission to read this essay. Check out the Xerces Society website. It's spelled xerces.org. Especially nice to hear from Cass Urban Mead. She's doing some great work. It'll be fun to follow her work into the future. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you for listening.